Omaha Public Radio presents another program from the Durham Museum Lecture Series on Noon Forum. Continuing our presentation of the museum's four-year-long series on the 150th anniversary of the Civil War, we'll hear the second of three talks on the year 1863. Our guest speaker will be Danielle Battisti, Assistant Professor of History at the University of Nebraska at Omaha. The title of her presentation will be The New York City Draft Riots and the Boundaries of Anti-Slavery Sentiment in the North. Dr. Battisti's lecture will focus on the events of the late summer and early fall of 1863 in the aftermath of Gettysburg. Her talk will place special emphasis on the often underappreciated issues of anti-war and anti-slavery sentiment in the North during the war, manifested most dramatically and violently in the draft riots at Rock, New York City, and other major cities during the summer of 1863. Those confrontations typically pitted recently arrived Irish immigrant groups against free blacks and often resulted in widespread bloodshed, death, and destruction at a time when the fate of the Union still remained very much in doubt. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Tuesday evening, July 30, 2013, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of the Durham Museum, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the program is Mick Hale, Director of Education at the Durham Museum.
Without any further ado, I'm very pleased to introduce our speaker tonight, Dr. Danielle Battisti, Associate Professor of History at the University of Nebraska, Omaha. Danielle gave this presentation 10 days ago to highly acclaimed reviews from those who attended. We're excited to have her back. Her topic tonight zeroes in on something kind of specific in 1863 and regarding the Civil War, and that would be the New York City draft riots and the anti-slavery sentiment that was prevailing in the North. So with that, I will turn it over to Danielle, and once again, I thank her for taking part in this series this year.
Thank you, Mick, and thank you all for giving up some portion of your evening tonight. Hopefully, it won't disappoint. So where I'm going to start off with is I'm starting off in July 1863, and I'm sort of picking up where Dr. Scheer left off with his last lecture. He made the argument that 1863 was the critical year of the Civil War, and I would agree, and I think the lecture tonight will kind of stress that point. That year witnessed two crucial turning points in the war that fundamentally changed not only the tide of the war, but the history of the nation. So I'm just going to recap a little bit before we get to our topic. The first turning point was a military turning point. After many years of grueling fighting in which Southern victories seemed to dominate, the tide of battle finally seemed to be turning toward the North in 1863. At Gettysburg, the Union Army critically halted the Southern advance in the North and struck a costly but enormously significant and demoralizing blow to the Confederacy. And in the West, Grant oversaw one of the most successful Union campaigns of the war at Vicksburg, thus taking control of much of the Mississippi and providing a much-needed sense of forceful leadership for the Union. But these battles were long coming and hard fought. In 1863, Lincoln had concluded that to win the war and to save the Union, the North had to wage the war more skillfully through diplomatic channels and on an ideological level as well as on battlefields. So these conclusions also prompted Lincoln to construct and to issue the Emancipation Proclamation, which is the second major turning point of the war in 1863. The Emancipation Proclamation, which began the process of freeing American slaves, albeit in imperfect and incomplete ways, was on its most basic level just another weapon in Lincoln's wartime arsenal. By proclaiming freedom to slaves in the South, Lincoln was promoting large-scale slave rebellions and runaways. Both rebellions and runaways would threaten the Confederacy's internal security, disrupt the dominant labor regime in plantation-based economies, divert resources from the army, and further weaken the already vulnerable Confederate dollar. But the Emancipation Proclamation, of course, does much more than this as well. It would also make it virtually impossible for the Confederacy to gain much-needed international recognition and critical financial and military aid from major powers in Europe, without which it could not hope to win the war of attrition that the Civil War was becoming by 1863. So why is this the case? Well, in issuing the Emancipation Proclamation, Lincoln also fundamentally transforms the nature of the war. He changed the war from a war to save the Union to a war to end slavery. And this is a major change that happens in 1863, and what I'm going to illustrate to you now is where he's moving from in the years before this. When the war began, Lincoln had initially resisted what were then still radical impulses to make the war a mandate about the future of slavery in the United States. This was part due to his own views about race and slavery, as well as for practical political reasons, keeping border states in the Union, things like this. Well into 1862, time and time again, Lincoln had insisted that the war was a conflict about legal or constitutional disagreements, a spat, if you will, among squabbling family members. He used language like this. He most famously articulated this position and affirmed once again that the war was not a fight about slavery in an August 1862 letter to Horace Greeley, which we have here. In this letter, he states, "My paramount object in this struggle is to save the Union. It is not either to save or to destroy slavery. If I could save the Union without freeing any slave, I would do it. And if I could save it by freeing all the slaves, I would do it. And if I could save it by freeing some and leaving others alone, I would also do that." But by 1863, Lincoln was gradually moving away from this former position. In part, like I said, this occurred out of military necessity. The next line from this letter, if we went on to read it, would read, "What I do about slavery and the colored race, I do because I believe it helps to save the Union." But in part, he is also moving because of a genuine evolution in his ideology about slavery, citizenship, and race in America as abolitionist influence grew during the war. So in issuing the Emancipation Proclamation and in firmly linking the war to the eventual emancipation of slaves, Lincoln's policy is, of course, more than just a military weapon. It ultimately transforms the war into a moral war in which the North now clearly stands for liberal ideas like freedom and a more perfect form of democracy. The short-term and military or diplomatic consequences of this action is that under these new circumstances, Great Britain, which is the Confederacy's chief trading partner and hope for aid, it has a strong abolitionist lobby, it has its own liberal traditions, and it will not dare take a stand against a now morally and politically virtuous North by recognizing and aiding the slave South. So this is very important. The longer-term and much more significant consequences of the Emancipation Proclamation for the purposes of today's discussion, and of course the enormous effects that it will have on the United States, are what does it do legally, socially, and ideologically? Americans understood that in abolishing slavery and eliminating the most basic structural barrier to African-American political, economic, and social advancement, Lincoln was altering the nature of the Constitution. He's altering the nature of citizenship in America and race relations in the nation. So some Americans welcome these potential changes, right? But many, in fact, most in the North, do not. So in the rest of today's discussion, what we're going to explore is the manifestations of American anxiety about the meaning of emancipation and the potential changing status of African Americans in the nation as a result. And what we're going to do is specifically use the New York City draft riots in the summer of 1863 to examine these anxieties and this phenomenon. So let's turn to the riots now. For four sweltering days in July 1863, and riots almost always happen on hot days when rational people want to kill each other anyway, New York City is besieged by mob violence, by arson, and the destruction of property. Only after the introduction of federal troops were rioters finally put down. The rioting was touched off by anti-war protesters resisting the institution of a national draft to replenish Union Army ranks. Thus, history records this event as the New York City draft riots. But if you look beneath the surface, these riots are only superficially or partly about the draft. The true details of the riot reveal that this event is, in fact, also a race riot in which working-class white Americans, particularly those at the political, social, and economic margin of things, voice their alarm about the changing nature of the war and future race relations in the nation. So it's not lost on Americans of all stripes that the Emancipation Proclamation signaled the emergence of something new. First, like the draft itself, it's a symbol of an increasingly powerful federal government that claimed the authority to create policy and law which could drastically change individual lives. And this is a relatively new and frightening prospect for Americans in the 19th century, because at this point, the federal government is a relatively distant and weak entity for most Americans. It's not the federal government that we know today. There's no national income taxes, no social welfare programs. Domestic social policies are not crafted by Washington. Essentially, the federal government is there to keep you out of war, wage foreign affairs, open up the West to homesteaders, and deliver your mail. And they don't even do that well most of the time. It doesn't really get involved in your daily life, right? But this is beginning to change during the Civil War. More and more Americans are recognizing and reacting to the fact that on some level, the American government is becoming more powerful, and they're not quite sure how to deal with that. Moreover, this increasingly powerful federal government seemed to many Americans to be actively fostering rapid change regarding the status of African Americans in the nation. If the Emancipation Proclamation laid the groundwork for the eventual abolition of slavery, then the draft symbolized the government's power to coerce all Americans to fight for this new vision of the war and a potentially very different society than the one that they lived in 1863. Many Americans who were less than enthusiastic about the prospect of millions of freed slaves naturally wondered what changes were to come yet. Would African Americans soon enjoy the same political and civil rights as whites? Or would the new status of African Americans radically alter racial hierarchies that had been in place since the nation's founding? Those who were most concerned about the new status that African Americans might enjoy after the war were, of course, Southerners, right? They're fighting against this. But also the poorest and most marginalized whites in northern American cities are also incensed about these potential changes. Here I'm talking about people who already competed with freed African Americans for jobs, for housing, and even status in the North feeling threatened. So in New York City, those whites at the lowest rungs of society are predominantly recent Irish immigrants. Irish immigration to the United States began en masse in the late 1830s and the early 1840s, when a succession of potato blights devastated the already destitute Irish peasants. So there's about 4 million immigrants total in this period, and you can see that the Irish make up 40% of them here. In this time period, we have tens of thousands of Irish pouring out of Ireland, first into Canada, because the British government's response is not to give aid, it's to subsidize travel to Canada. Then they start pouring into northern U.S. port cities like Boston, Philadelphia, and especially New York City in the years before the Civil War. But when the Irish arrive in the United States, they're not really welcomed. The Irish are different than almost all older waves of immigrants to the United States in two respects. One, they are the poorest of the poor, and two, they're Catholic. Both of these characteristics make the Irish largely unwelcomed, suspect, and kept at the margins of American society by older stock Americans. So I want to take a look now at both of these two characteristics that I just mentioned. I want to take a look at them in depth, talk about a little bit more about why they're important. So the first thing I mention is the Irish are become the poorest of the poor in the United States. Why is this important? In the early 19th century, most European immigrants who came to the U.S. were not the social dregs of their homelands. Most of them had enough money, enough resources, and social capital to come to the United States in family units and to make it out of eastern port cities and to move on west, where they could purchase land and establish small family farms. And these farms are important. These immigrants and American native-born peoples, when they own their own land, this means something in the United States. This gives them political independence, which is important in a democracy because it means that your boss or your landowner can't tell you how to vote, right? So it's very important that newcomers can fit into this trope, can become these idealized citizens that will keep this young democracy functioning. But what happens when the Irish come is they're largely illiterate, starving peasants, and they don't fit this mold. If they're lucky enough to make it to North America in the first place, most of them never make it out of these eastern port cities like New York. In cities like New York, they're forced to take the worst jobs, live in the poorest housing, and eke out a precarious existence. So we have immigrants living in very poor tenement housing, dilapidated buildings, not fitting this idealized mold. Moreover, the Irish are arriving in American cities just as cities are becoming industrial hubs with big city problems. Problems like cheap, unskilled workers and machines displacing skilled craftsmen. So we have the first labor conflicts. We see the emergence of problems like poor sanitation, disease, overcrowding, urban crime, and the emergence of vice industries like gambling, prostitution, etc., drinking. So when Americans see these issues emerge, many of them don't see them as problems that emerge out of industrialization and urbanization. They see them as problems that emerge out of the Irish coming to the U.S., right? It's the scapegoating of immigrants. So this is an important characteristic that makes the Irish problematic. They're poor. They don't make it out of the cities. The second problem is that the Irish immigrants who come to the United States are really the first Catholic immigrants to come en masse. So the Irish are the first large non-Protestant group to come to a Protestant nation. In the 19th century, Americans prided themselves on their Protestant identity. According to them, Protestantism was a forward-looking religion associated with Enlightenment rationality and one that fostered individualism and equality. In short, it's a religion that's fit for democracy. On the other hand, many Americans viewed Catholicism as backward, associated with authoritarian regimes of the past, like absolute monarchs, and antiquated rituals and superstitions, things like priestly regalia, incense, the belief in transubstantiation. They likewise viewed Catholicism as a religion that stressed unquestioning obedience to established hierarchies, kings, popes, bishops, and priests. So it's one that they think squashes rational and independent thought. So if you follow this line of reasoning, a large Catholic influx might threaten the very nature of American democracy and citizenship. So a lot of the cartoons from this period reflect those fears. The one on the left is depicting this foreign invasion across the Atlantic led by popes, bishops, priests, etc. The one on the right is depicting what might happen to the American education or school system if Catholics get in charge of public schools and can indoctrinate young citizens and corrupt their minds, right? similar cartoons. Again, the Catholic menace wearing the papal crown on the alligator comes over and not only threatens American cities, but you see Washington, D.C. and government being threatened in the background. Here we have, again, an Irish immigrant looking very ape-like and a Catholic priest stuffing the Democratic ballot box around election time and corrupting elections. So for all of these reasons, extreme anti-Irish prejudices emerge in the years leading up to the Civil War, when the Irish are flooding American cities. The most extreme example of this anti-Irish movement is the emergence of an organized nativist political party commonly known as the Know-Nothings. And the Know-Nothings seek to limit immigrant, and read Irish Catholic here, influence on naturalization, voting rights, public office, and other provisions to limit Catholic influence in the nation. So the Know-Nothings propose things like mandatory Bible readings in public schools. But beyond the sphere of organized politics, anti-Irish sentiment also manifests itself in everyday acts of prejudice. So what we see are the emergence in American cities of a social order in which poor Irish immigrants occupy the lowest rungs of white society, just one step above blacks on the social ladder. In cities like New York, Irish immigrants often compete with free blacks for the lowest paid, most undesirable, unskilled work. Men are often street sweepers, day laborers, women become domestic servants. What you see here is, again, a very ape-like Irishman doing one of these poor jobs. His wife is in the background. His kid is trash picking here. They're living in these horrible conditions. And then you have this old stock American represented in this out of mode patriotic garb, sort of aghast at this situation. We also have a situation in which Irish immigrants and African Americans are forced to live by both economic and social prejudices in the same low-class housing sections of the city. When whites do socialize with blacks in New York, and we have, again, a city here that has de facto, not de jure, segregation, it is, again, only the poorest of the poor, often the Irish, who are socializing with blacks. So, for example, in the years leading up to the Civil War, if a free African American were to go into a white tavern or a brothel, he would probably be mixing with Irish immigrants in those spaces. And then the last point I want to make, and this might sound sort of strange to modern ears, but in these years, many Americans even questioned whether or not the Irish were truly white. And you can think about those less than human ape-like images that you just saw. We now understand that whiteness is not determined by biology, right, or nature, that we as a society determine who is white and who is not white. That means that this concept is fluid, it's evolving, and it's constructed by us. And in this time period, there are many Americans who don't consider the Irish white. To give you an example of how this works, take a look at someone like George Zimmerman, who's been in the news lately, right? This guy is a Hispanic American, and I would venture to guess that at many points in his life, he has been considered by others as non-white. But the events, recent events, have sort of whitened him in the eyes of American society. So this is a very fluid, changing construct, and it's questionable where the Irish are in this period in the 1850s, 1860s. So the only thing that the Irish really have going for them in the United States is that they are elevated above the lowest members of American society. They can't be legally enslaved like blacks can, and they have political rights, voting rights. And that's not usually the case even for free blacks in the North. Again, sometimes by law, sometimes by custom. But now the Emancipation Proclamation, it seems to be changing the tone of the war, and it seems to be changing these realities about race. So the Emancipation Proclamation, again, is clearly linking African-American struggles for freedom and equality with the nature of the war now, and this can potentially change the precarious hold that the Irish and other white urban poor have in American society. So again, when we take a look at the New York City draft riots, what you see up close is mostly groups of Irish American and Irish immigrant rioters rebelling against an increasingly powerful state that might now have the authority to change established political and social hierarchies. They're also rebelling against the state's new radical racial policies, and you also see these rebellions against upper and middle class New Yorkers that supported Lincoln and the Republicans. Now, what I want to do is read to you an account of the riot that illustrates this point, that the riots are much more about the anxiety about the changing nature of African-American status in the nation, they're as much about that as they are about anti-government, anti-war sentiment. And so I'm going to be reading you an account that two historians put together. Their names are Burroughs and Wallace. They published a book called Gotham. And they used newspaper and telegram accounts to play-by-play of some particular points of the riot together. And in this account, they're going to use language that's being used at the time that includes racial slurs that I'm not comfortable saying, but I think you all know what it is, and it's important to mentally insert that word, so I'll say blank, and please think about what it means. Okay, it's very dark here. Bear with me. Bands of Irish longshoremen with quarrymen, street pavers, teamsters, and cartmen following along began chasing blacks, screaming, "Kill all blank." Blacks were dragged off streetcars and stages around City Hall. The owner of a colored sailor's boarding house on Roosevelt Street in the Fourth Ward was robbed and stripped, his building fired. Maria Prince's boarding house in Sullivan Street was trashed as rioters dug up paving stones, smashed the windows, and ransacked it. A crowd tried to attack black waiters at Crook's restaurant in Chatham Square but was repulsed. Uptown at 5th Avenue and 43rd, rioters attacked the colored orphan asylum, screaming, "Burn the blank nest." The 237 children, most under 12 years old, escaped, young Patty McCafferty heroically shepherding them to the 20th Precinct House, while the crowd smashed pianos, carried off carpets and iron bedsteads, uprooted the trees, shrubs, and fences, and then set the building ablaze. Crowds would attack other moral reform projects, even those not associated with blacks. They stoned the Magdalen Asylum on 5th and 88th Street and burned down the Five Points Mission. When night fell, the racial assaults worsened. Some blacks were attacked on the corner of Varick and Carlton Streets by a crowd led by an Irish bricklayer. One of the pursued turned, shot the bricklayer with a pistol, and escaped. The maddened crowd grabbed one of the others, lynched him, and then burned the corpse. Gangs attacked and torched waterfront tenements, dance houses, brothels, bars, and boarding houses that catered to black working men. Furniture was burned in sidewalk bonfires. Bands of small boys would mark the victims' houses by stoning windows and then return with older men to finish the job. Racially mixed couples, white women who consorted with blacks, anyone who defied taboos on amalgamation were specifically targeted. By midweek, rioters had virtually emptied the downtown waterfront of blacks. So rioting goes on like this for about 3 days. And, of course, combined a mix of attacks on African Americans in the city, like I just read to you, agents or institutions of the state, especially Republican Party officials and their offices, and finally rich and middle-class New Yorkers, both because they tended to support the Republican Party and because of class anxieties that happened during rioting. This is an opportunity to loot the wealthy and redistribute property. You see this in many riots. Rioting is finally put down only after the arrival of federal troops on the night of the third day of the riots. Fighting goes on between troops Wednesday night and all day Thursday before authorities are able to retake the city. So let's turn now to the aftermath of these riots. Contemporaries believed that upwards of 1,000 people had died in the riots, A verified body count only exists for 119 people. I tend to think that it is probably more people. There are probably more people who died, given the fact that record keeping in this era is not great, especially for these low income areas of the city and areas that include African American districts, which are not always properly counted. Some historians estimate as high as 2,000 people died. I think that number is probably too high. As the army came through, it noted how rioters had hanged, drowned, and mutilated black men, burned black homes, destroyed Republican mansions, and attacked Protestant missions, which are a symbol of how the Irish are sort of the scourge who are always in need of being reformed. No official accounts of wounded citizens and property damage exist, but again, best estimates are around 8,000 wounded and about 1 to 5 million in property damage, which is a wide range, but it depends on what you count as property. And so one can only speculate that the damage is very, very high. The official response from the state is actually relatively mild. There are no mass investigations or punishments, and there's no imposition of martial law in the city. Lincoln and Republicans feared alienating opposition groups even further and fomenting even more internal unrest during the war if they came down hard on the protesters. For the most part, the state relied on local New York officials in Tammany Hall to condemn lawlessness and assaults on property, and they only pursued a handful of arrests and prosecutions. The government does keep a few contingent of troops in certain sections of the city, particularly at draft offices, but given all that happened, this is a very mild response. So what I think we need to take away from the New York City draft riots and other smaller riots in other northern cities that occur in late 1862 and 1863, because this is not the only one, it's just the most important one, is a couple of things. First, we can view the draft riots as anti-statist expressions. These are riots that signaled anxiety that many Americans had about the growing power and authority of the federal government as it waged war. Military necessities and Lincoln's role as commander-in-chief enabled his administration to go outside of normal political channels to create change. The issuance of the Emancipation Proclamation, which is an executive order rather than a congressional or a state vote, begins the process of abolishing slavery on a national level, and this is an almost unprecedented example of federal power. Likewise, the draft gave the federal government unprecedented power to encroach upon the day-to-day lives of American men and their families. Some Americans wondered where the state's authority would end. So Americans recognized that these wartime precedents might fundamentally change the relationship between citizens and their government. So on the one level, we view draft riots as an expression of anxiety over these changes. We can also view the riots as demonstrations that there are significant limits on anti-slavery sentiment in the North during the Civil War. When we look back at the war in retrospect, we tend to idealize the Civil War as one where all Northerners fought against Southerners to eradicate the evil stain of slavery and racism from the nation's history. But what we've seen here today is that it's important that we realize that many Americans, even Northerners, only grudgingly, reluctantly came to embrace the idea that the Civil War was being fought to create a more egalitarian society. We need to recognize that the nature of the war evolved over time, and that certain groups of Americans, especially the working class, poor American-born whites, and marginalized immigrants, were the most difficult groups to bring into the fold, and many of them never were. For them, their whiteness was contingent upon keeping African-Americans politically and economically subjugated. And this is something that the nation would continue to struggle with for the next 100 years and more. And then finally, in I think the next lecture in this series will hit this point home a little bit more when Dr. Scheer continues this discussion, is that we can we have to put the draft riots in the context of how the nation is going to interpret what's happening in 1863. And I think we need to foreshadow or take a look at what happens next, and that's Lincoln's Gettysburg Address. When we take a look at this speech, and again, Dr. Scheer will look at it much, much more in the next lecture, this speech can be read as a speech in which Lincoln continues to lead the nation into embracing the new nature of the war. The war becomes a moral war about perfecting democracy and embracing a more inclusive definition of Americanism. So the riots are leading into that transition, and understanding the riots and the change in the Emancipation Proclamation is coming with that. I hope that you'll keep in mind the audience that we saw today of reluctant Unionists as people that Lincoln is addressing when he is crafting the Emancipation the Gettysburg Address in the fall of 1863. So he's trying to redefine the nature of the war and bring even reluctant Americans into accepting that changing meaning. So thank you for listening to what I have to say. I'm open to many questions, but I would love if you would bear in mind that I'm not a historian of the Civil War. I specialize in race and ethnicity and immigration in the United States. Thank you. Were the Irish welcomed into the Union Army? Yes, both the Union and the Confederate Army is ready and willing to accept anyone that wants to fight for them, right? And the Irish do volunteer in numbers. There's Irish brigades or companies, I'm not sure what the correct term are, that come out of New York City, and there's thousands, hundreds of thousands of them, right? And this is a good career path for many struggling immigrants that are trying to make ends meet, that want to send money back home to their families. And the Union is very willing to accept them. And there are plenty of Irish that don't fit the mold of people that I've been talking about today. So some are patriotic. Some do support the Union cause. In the account of the race riot that I read to you, there's one Irish American who helps liberate those orphans from that colored orphan asylum that's being attacked. So there's a wide variety of sentiment, including those who do want to fight for the Union, and they are welcomed.
A member of the audience asked whether the riots were actually about the draft or also about other things, such as immigrant status or race.
I think that they are legitimately worried about being drafted because, while there are some who want to fight, there are plenty that don't. And the draft is a very real and scary prospect for many Americans, not just the Irish, but for poor Americans that cannot afford to hire a substitute, buy their way out of the draft. So I would argue that the riots are a combination of both anti-draft riots and race riots, and that these sentiments are linked. Because what's linking them is the power of the state. The state can compel you to join the army. The state can compel you to change the social order of the nation, your economic status, how you interact with people around you. And so I don't want to say that they're only a race riot. They're certainly a draft riot, but I think we have to give both sort of factors equal weight. The question is about the Copperhead Movement, right? So that there is a significant degree of anti-slavery sentiment in the North, opposition to the war, certainly the Democratic Party, Copperheads within the Democratic Party, Copperheads are leading this anti-war charge, right? And so there are some Irish that are part of that movement, but I would say for the most part, when you take a look at the Irish, we're talking about people who in the race riots are not working in normal political channels like the Copperheads would be operating in. That these riots are irrational expressions of anxiety and fear. And so that I think we need to some degree, separate them from the normal political process, because they're a symbol that normal politics is not adequate, or it's not addressing, you know, the real concerns or the deep fears of the people who are participating. participating. But certainly that issue is very important in demonstrating, again, not everyone in the North is fully behind the war or the changing meaning of the war in 1863.
Dr. Battisti was asked to comment about the influence of nativism in the riots.
Well, I wouldn't want to draw too many similarities between contemporary nativism and any other wave of nativism. There are certainly usually things that repeat themselves time and time again. So we see periods of heightened nativism in times of economic change. So in this era, it's the change to industrialization and urbanization and people not quite understanding the effects that that's having on society, so they blame immigrants. Today, you might say the same thing, that to some degree we have entered into a post-industrial economy, and to some degree, instead of understanding those changes, you can say, well, it's the influx of low working-class laborers or outsourcing, things like this, that are creating the problems. So there are, I think, definitely those similarities.
The next questioner asked whether most soldiers on both sides of the war were drafted or were volunteers.
Okay, so this is a question I anticipated and looked up the numbers for. I have the numbers for the Northern Army. So there are about 2 million Northern troops, and 2% of them are draftees, and 6% of them are paid substitutes for draftees. So we're not talking about an overwhelming number, because there is a lot of patriotic sentiment, and there's a lot of willingness of people for economic reasons to join the Army, and these new immigrants keep replenishing the ranks, which is something that the Confederacy doesn't have. So the North, one, doesn't need to institute the draft until 1863, and it doesn't even rely on it as much as maybe we think that it does. The Confederacy has a bigger problem with the draft in that compelling people to do something or states to do something is the very sort of thing that they're fighting against or rebelling against. So they resist the draft much longer and I think resort to it at the very last minute, and it really doesn't make a difference, and we're not talking about large numbers at all. So the question is about how do we characterize the New York City draft riots. So there's a series of riots that occur in late 1862 and 1863. And these happen in cities. There are draft riots in Boston, Philadelphia, Buffalo, Providence, New York City, and a couple others. There are just race riots in Cincinnati, New Albany, Ohio, Toledo, Chicago, Brooklyn, Buffalo, some other cities, right? So the riots that are specifically race riots tend to happen in late 1862 when Lincoln has empowered the military to start hiring freed blacks or contrabands to do work for them, and therefore the Irish and other working class poor in these cities lose their jobs. So I would say that those types of riots are exclusively race riots. I think that the draft riots, like the one in New York and these other cities that I mentioned, are a combination of these anti-statist elements and the racial anxieties. So I guess the answer is this particular riot, I think, is a combination of what the draft riots represent and not exclusively a race riot. How does the status of the Irish change over time? I would say that in the post-war period, the Irish do see a bump in their social status, but it's not really because of some of the issues that we've talked about today. It's because in the 1870s, 80s, and 90s, there starts to be even more problematic newcomers coming to the United States. That now there are Catholics and Jews coming from Southern and Eastern Europe, like Italians, Poles, Czechs, Hungarians, Russians, who are even more culturally problematic for Americans than the Irish are. So the Irish start to look more white. They start to look more American. Their Catholicism becomes less problematic because, in contrast to Italian Catholics that believe in all these sort of superstitions and backwoods festivals, they look more mainstream. So their status starts to change because there's an even lower rung that starts to come in. And the same thing happens to the Germans. The Germans fare a lot better than the Irish for a variety of reasons, but they see their status uptick as well because of these newcomers. And also, after the Civil War, we're starting to talk about a second generation emerge. So we're not talking about an immigrant cohort. So there are people that are Irish Americans that learn American English, go through the American school system, and experience some upward mobility like most second-generation immigrants do. I would say that their service in the Union Army does confer a badge of honor on some Irish American communities, as does, you know, their political participation overall, because these are people that have been absorbed into political machines by the late 19th century. But again, it's a variety of factors that sort of changes this.
An audience member asked Dr. Battisti to comment on Lincoln's transition from saving the Union to anti-slavery.
Well, you know, there are transitions that you make in private and transitions that you're willing to make in public. So this is a gradual evolving process, and I think that you're right that Lincoln is moving toward changing his conception of slavery, of the nature of the war in 1862, 1863, but the company line until 1863 is really, this is about saving the Union. Okay, so the question is about obtaining citizenship for immigrants. You need to be in the United States for a period of 5 years to become a citizen, and some states have something called an intent to become a citizen that you can fill out after usually 2 years. So you can actually vote in some states even before you become a citizen in the 19th century. It's not standardized, or it's not reflective of what we do today. So you can actually be incorporated into the nation much more quickly in the 19th century than you can now, and it's a very, very easy process. You go through a very cursory citizenship test. You swear a loyalty oath to the United States. You really don't have to jump through a lot of hoops. What the American Nativist Party wanted to do is raise the requirement to 21 years. So essentially weed out a generation of newcomers, and it's their children that will really become citizens. So the question is about leadership. Very good question, and it's actually very difficult to answer that question because riots tend to be sort of spontaneous combustions of violence, and they happen in a grassroots kind of way. There's not any kind of planning or organization that spearheads it. I would say that there is a sort of gang or youth culture that does exist in the Irish American community that could be at the forefront of these riots. But part of the problem is illiterate people who are engaging in criminal activity don't leave a lot of records about how it happened, right? So these are things that we're piecing together from newspaper accounts. And like I said, there's not really arrests or trials afterwards. So it's very hard to answer that question. And it's a good one. All right, well, thank you very much for listening, and hopefully you'll join Dr. Scheer for the next lecture. Thank you.
You've been listening to a program from the Durham Museum Lecture Series on Noon Forum. Continuing our presentation of the museum's 4-year-long series on the 150th anniversary of the Civil War, we've heard the second of 3 talks on the year 1863. Our guest speaker has been Danielle Battisti, Assistant Professor of History at the University of Nebraska at Omaha. The title of her presentation has been The New York City Draft Riots and the Boundaries of Anti-Slavery Sentiment in the North. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Tuesday evening, July 30, 2013, for broadcast at this time. Listen next Monday, February 24th at 12 noon, for the third and final program in this series of lectures on the year 1863. The guest speaker will once again be Mark Scheer, Associate Professor and Chairman of the Department of History at the University of Nebraska at Omaha. His topic will be Lincoln at Gettysburg, Finding Meaning in an Ongoing Tragedy. Special thanks to Patty O'Brien, Director of Marketing and Public Relations at the Durham Museum, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of over 300 previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.